At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Story 1. I've been with the force for about 15 years now. Most of it spent patrolling the quieter outskirts of Manchester. It's not the kind of work that makes headlines. More about long stretches of road, endless paperwork, and the occasional domestic call. Our patch stretches far into the countryside, and when it gets late or the roads go dead quiet, there's a strange kind of stillness that settles in. You start to feel like the world has emptied out, like you're the last one left driving through it. This happened one Tuesday afternoon, clear skies and crisp air, while I was out alone in the squad car following up on a report of a stolen vehicle somewhere near Saddleworth Moor. The roads were almost entirely empty when I saw her. She was just standing there, right in the middle of the road, barefoot, wearing a thin white summer dress that had no business being out in that kind of cold. Her long brown hair hung loose over her shoulders, but what stopped me was how utterly motionless she was. She wasn't trying to wave me down or walking towards safety. She was simply fixed in place, like something out of a still photograph. I slowed the car and lowered the window, calling out to her, but she didn't so much as blink. Pulling over with the hazards on, I stepped out, the countryside around me completely silent, except for the faint sound of birds somewhere far away. Even from a few feet away, she didn't react, her wide eyes locked straight ahead, as though she was looking through me rather than at me. I'd seen shock before, victims of assaults or accidents with that faraway look. But this was different. There wasn't fear, confusion, or anything human behind her eyes. It was emptiness. Her skin, when I reached out to gently touch her arm, was ice cold. No shiver, no flinch. Just the same unbroken stare. Then she began to move, slowly turning in place, one complete circle and then another, as though she was compelled by some strange rhythm only she could hear. I radioed in for backup and an ambulance, suspecting drugs or some kind of severe mental health episode, and prepared to guide her off the road. Before I could, she spun a little too far and lost her balance, collapsing straight backward. The back of her head smacked against the grill of my car with a dull, heavy thud that made my stomach turn. She crumpled to the ground instantly, limbs loose like a marionette with its strings cut. I knelt beside her, keeping my voice calm as I checked for a pulse. Still no sound from her, but her eyes were wide open, staring upward at the sky with the same glassy expression. Then I noticed the redness creeping into her face. Not the natural flush from pain, but an intense, almost unnatural crimson. Her eyes began watering heavily, but it wasn't from crying. She was forcing herself to look straight into the sun, unblinking, as if it was the only thing that mattered. I tried blocking her view by holding a clipboard over her face from the car. She didn't try to move it, didn't shift away. She simply lay there, still staring in the same direction, as if my intervention meant nothing. When the ambulance finally arrived, I gave the crew the details. Early 20s, unresponsive, possible head injury, and they moved quickly to get her onto a stretcher. Even as they wheeled her into A&E, she hadn't made a single sound. Inside the hospital, I stuck around to give a statement. The staff tried to get her to sit up, but she wouldn't. Wanted to help her stand, and she crumpled immediately as though her body had forgotten how to support itself. Someone asked her name, no reply. Then without warning, she jerked her arms up into a rigid position, one arm bent outward like a spout, the other tucked stiffly against her hip. It looked like a strange frozen version of the "I'm a little teapot" pose. She stayed like that, her arms locked in place no matter how they tried to adjust them. An hour passed and nothing changed. She didn't speak, didn't blink, didn't shift. I'd seen catatonia before, but there was something about this that felt wrong in a way I couldn't put my finger on. A nurse leaned in quietly and said that if she was faking, she was better than anyone they'd ever seen, but they didn't think she was in control of it. Eventually, psych was called, and I was told I could leave. I took a few steps toward the exit, then glanced back for one last look. That's when I saw it. Her head was now sharply tilted toward me, though I hadn't seen her move. Her arms were still in that unnatural position, but her face had changed. There was a faint, deliberate smile curling at her lips. Then her eyes rolled back until they were completely white. I didn't wait for anyone to say anything. I turned and walked straight out of the building, not looking back. Sitting in the squad car afterward, I tried to reason with myself. Drugs, a mental break, some neurological event. That's what it had to be. But the truth is, I've seen more than my share of trauma, psychosis, and all the ways the human brain can break down under pressure. And still, I have never seen anything quite like her. Story 2. I used to work as an EMT covering a lonely stretch of northeastern Colorado. Most nights were quiet, sometimes eerily so. And if the weather was calm, the silence could almost feel oppressive. My younger brother Trevor worked as a deputy with the county sheriff's office. And when my shift was slow, I'd sometimes ride along with him until a call came in. It was a way to keep myself awake during those long dead hours. Out here, once you pass midnight, the towns turned into nothing more than shapes in the dark. Amherst, for example, wasn't even a proper town, more like a blink and you miss it spot on the map. Maybe 50 people in total, a few weather-beaten houses, an abandoned church, one towering grain elevator, and a small forgotten park just off a dirt road. No streetlights, no traffic. Just blackness and open sky. The kind of place where you could scream and not a single person would hear you. On this particular night, the air was perfectly still, cold enough to sting the skin. We were wrapping up our last round when Trevor suggested we pass through Amherst one more time, more out of habit than necessity. The cruiser hummed softly over the dirt road, headlights catching the empty shapes of the park's old playground equipment. I was already half thinking about getting back to the station, when something shifted in the corner of my vision. It was nothing dramatic, just a faint flicker of movement in the dark, subtle enough that I almost dismissed it. But Trevor slowed down, his eyes fixed on the shadows by the swings. The spotlight swept across the park, illuminating rusting monkey bars, a weather-worn slide, and the metal seesaw that had been there for decades. Then the beam settled on the swing set, and that's when I saw her. There was a girl sitting on the middle swing, motionless. Her back was to us, her head slightly tilted forward as if studying the ground beneath her feet. Long black hair fell straight down, partly obscuring her face. She couldn't have been more than 12 or 13, dressed in a thin white dress completely unsuited for the cold. She didn't sway. She didn't fidget. The chains of the swing were perfectly still. It was as if someone had placed a statue there. Trevor and I just sat in silence, staring at her. It struck me how unnatural it was for a child to be out here at this hour, in this weather, in a place with no houses nearby. He tried speaking to her through the car's loudspeaker, telling her it wasn't safe, asking if she needed help. She didn't move, not even a twitch. The stillness was almost worse than if she had screamed or run. I remember thinking it looked like she wasn't breathing. We kept watching her, waiting for any sign of life. Then, without warning, she was simply gone. One moment she was there, the next the swing was empty, swaying just slightly as if it had been disturbed seconds earlier. There was no sound of running, no glimpse of her moving away, just empty space where she had been. I instinctively scanned the park, expecting to see her darting behind the slide or slipping into the shadows, but there was nothing. The place was wide open, no trees, no bushes, nowhere to hide in an instant like that. I started to say we should check the area, but Trevor's reaction stopped me cold. His knuckles had gone white on the steering wheel, and he was already shifting the cruiser back into gear. His eyes were fixed straight ahead, and there was an edge in his voice I'd rarely heard before. It was fear, real and unfiltered. We drove away without another word, the glow of the spotlight still fading in my mind. When we reached the station, I asked if he thought it was just some kid messing with us. He shook his head and told me something that still makes my stomach twist. When the light hit her, he said, he'd been looking closely at the ground under her feet. The dirt was completely smooth. No footprints, no drag marks. It didn't even look like her shoes were touching the ground at all. More like she was suspended an inch above the swing. That detail kept me awake all night, playing over in my mind. I've been on countless calls since then. Wrecks, overdoses, even scenes that made me question my own sanity. But nothing has stuck with me like that night in Amherst. I don't claim to know what we saw. Maybe there's some explanation, something rational that my brain just can't piece together. But I know what I didn't see. Any possible way for that girl to leave without us noticing. Trevor and I never went back to that park. And if you ever find yourself driving through Amherst, Colorado, after dark, I'd suggest you do the same. Whatever you think about ghosts, there's something by those swings that you don't want to meet. Story 3. I used to work desk shifts at the police department in a tiny Midwest town called Mineral Springs. It's the kind of place where you know almost everyone by name, and the wildest call you usually get is a complaint about a raccoon in someone's attic. My shift back then was the 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. slot. Nothing exciting most nights, just picking up calls, filing reports, and signing off on routine paperwork. That particular night was late October, the kind of cold that seeps into your bones and makes the wind sound like it's moving with a purpose. Around 9:20 p.m., the ancient fire alarm board in the office suddenly lit up. It was registering a signal from a house on Lindell Street. That system was a relic, barely worked, and maybe 10 properties in town were still hooked into it. Way before my time, the PD used to offer alarm monitoring to residents. The service ended in the 80s, but dismantling the whole setup would have been a headache, so it was left running, collecting dust more than anything else. I called it in to dispatch, but Beth, our night shift operator, had just clocked in early and answered it instead. I was about to step outside for a smoke when the 911 line rang. Same address, Lindell Street. I picked it up, expecting to hear someone panicked on the other end. But there was nothing. No static, no background noise, no hang-up click. Just an unnatural silence, like the line was open but dead. I stared at the display for a couple seconds longer than I should have, before shaking it off and deciding I'd better go check it out myself. I yelled to Beth that I was heading over, grabbed the keys to a squad car, and radioed in on Channel 3, the line we share with the fire department. By the time I turned on to Lindell, another unit had arrived. Gibbs, an older officer with a Marine Corps background and nerves I'd never seen rattled. We both got out expecting to see smoke pouring out of a window, or maybe even flames, but the house was perfectly still under the dim glow of the street lamp. Curtains drawn, no lights on, no signs of fire. That's when we noticed two women walking slowly up the sidewalk. One was pushing the other in a wheelchair. They didn't look distressed at all, just mildly surprised to see two squad cars outside their place. The younger woman, maybe late 60s, explained that they lived there and had just returned from a short walk before dinner. When we told her about the alarm signal and the 911 call, she seemed confused. She said they hadn't had an alarm system in decades, had it removed during renovations back in 98. Just normal battery-powered detectors now. She insisted no one else lived with them, and they hadn't had any visitors. The older woman in the wheelchair stayed quiet the whole time, her eyes fixed on the dark silhouette of the house in a way that made me feel unsettled. The younger one agreed to let us walk through the property to check things out. She said she'd open the back door for us while we went around. As soon as we got to the rear of the house, Gibbs and I both caught it, the sharp metallic stench of gas. Not faint either, strong enough to make your stomach turn. I radioed it in while Gibbs shined his flashlight into the kitchen window. Through the glass, we saw a faint blue flicker behind the oven. His reaction was instant. He swore under his breath, wrenched the back door open, and I sprinted to the main shutoff valve outside to kill the gas. Once we aired the place out with the help of a portable fan from the squad car, we found the culprit. A cracked gas line behind the stove. The daughter told us she'd spilled coffee earlier in the day, moved the oven to clean underneath, and must have damaged the pipe when pushing it back. From the look of things, the leak had been steady for hours. One spark, a light switch, even static, and that place could have gone up like a tinderbox. We combed through the rest of the property but found nothing unusual. Both phones were in place, untouched. The strange part was that there was no evidence anyone had made a call or triggered an alarm. Later, our tech guy pulled the logs. The fire alarm signal came in at 9:19 and 6 seconds. 3 seconds later, 9:19 and 9 seconds, the 911 line opened. But here's the kicker. The alarm system had been manually disabled on our end 15 years earlier. It wasn't just dormant. There was literally no connection for it to send anything. And the 9/11 record showed the line opening without any number ever being dialed. Almost like the system had called itself. Chief Rollins arrived not long after we'd cleared the scene. He was already well past retirement age, but still stuck around in an advisory role. When he saw the two women, he froze. Then he walked over and hugged them both tightly, with a look in his eyes I'd never seen from him before. Later, he told me the older woman was Helen. Her husband had been the fire chief here for nearly 30 years back in the 1950s. The younger woman's husband had also been on the volunteer fire department before dying in a car crash just a few years back. Rollins said Helen's husband had personally installed the original alarm system in their house. In fact, it had been the first property hooked up to it. The next day, curiosity got the better of me, and I drove back off duty. The daughter answered the door and thanked me again for the night before. Then she mentioned something that made my skin crawl. She said her mother didn't remember much these days, but the previous night she had asked if Jack had come to visit. When I asked who Jack was, the daughter explained that it was her father, the fire chief. He'd been dead for over 40 years. I've been to some grim scenes over the years. Murders, overdoses, suicides. I've seen the absolute worst in people and in luck. But that night on Lindell Street still gnaws at me. There's no reason any call should have come in from that house. No reason for the alarm to activate. No logical way the system should have worked after all these years. Yet somehow, something alerted us. Something that seemed to know the danger before anyone else did. I don't claim to believe in ghosts, but if there was ever a moment that made me question it, it was that one. Story 4. People often ask if, in my years as a deputy sheriff in rural southern Oregon, I've ever come across something I couldn't explain. I usually tell them I've seen just about everything. People tearing their own teeth out while high on meth, wild animals tearing apart chicken coops, and even cold-blooded murderers calmly waiting for us to arrive. I've always thought I had a firm grasp on reality, but there's one call I worked a few years back that still gnaws at me. I don't like thinking about it much. It was around 4 years ago, on a night shift that had me covering a patchwork of tiny backwoods towns and miles of forested wilderness. At about 12:40 a.m., dispatch sent me on a welfare check. An older woman living alone had called in to say someone was banging on both her front and back doors. She was way off the beaten path, down an unmarked dirt road on the edge of the Fremont-Winema National Forest. No close neighbors, nothing but thick trees on every side. The sort of setting that would make you uneasy before anything even happened. I reached her place around 1:15 a.m. The air was biting cold, late fall, and the only light came from her flickering porch bulb. The house looked as though the woods had been slowly swallowing it for years. The crunch of my tires on her gravel driveway sounded almost unnaturally loud in the stillness. She was already waiting at the front door when I got out of my cruiser. A rail-thin woman in her late 70s, wrapped in a worn bathrobe, clutching one of those oversized old-fashioned flashlights. She didn't seem frightened so much as weary and irritated. When I asked what was going on, she explained that they kept trying to get in. She claimed not to know who they were, only that they never spoke, just knocked, always around the same time at night, always loud as if they wanted her to open the door. She said they never actually entered, because she never allowed it. She kept glancing toward the shed out back, and I asked if I could take a look around. She gave a small nod and stepped aside. I circled the house first. The ground was still soft from rain the day before, but I found no footprints, no tire tracks, nothing to indicate that anyone had been walking around the property. Out back, the shed caught my attention. It was big, almost the size of a single-car garage, and the lock was hanging open, the door left slightly ajar. I swung it open the rest of the way and had to stop myself from instinctively taking a step back. The entire space was crammed with dolls. Not store-bought porcelain ones, but handmade. Stitched from fabric, burlap, and wood. Most were about 2 or 3 feet tall, and all of them were seated upright, facing the doorway. Some sat on old wooden chairs, others cross-legged on the floor. A few had crudely painted black eyes and smiles. Some had no faces at all. And disturbingly, some seemed to have actual human hair. The shed was so silent I could hear my own heartbeat in my ears. I've walked into meth labs covered in foil and blood, but the atmosphere in that shed was wrong. Every hair on my arms was standing up. When I finally backed out and closed the door, she was suddenly right behind me. I hadn't heard her approach. She told me she'd made the dolls for company, back before the knocking began, and that she hadn't been bothered back then. Her tone was calm, almost casual, like it was the most normal thing in the world. She then asked if I wanted to hear it. Confused, I asked what she meant, and she said they would knock again soon, that they always did, and suggested we wait inside. Despite my better judgment, I agreed. Maybe it was the thought of making sure she wasn't just losing her mind from isolation. Inside, the place was dim, lit only by a few oil lamps. Antique furniture filled the rooms, and faded family photos lined the walls. Smaller dolls, each turned to face the front door, sat in a neat row along the mantel. Without asking, she poured tea, and we sat at the kitchen table in silence, the ticking of an old clock marking the minutes. At exactly 1:59 a.m., the sound came, three loud, deliberate knocks on the front door. She didn't react at all, just sat there like she'd been expecting it. I stood up and told her to stay put while I went to check. The porch was empty. The still night pressed in on every side. No movement, no footprints, no wind. Then from the back door came another three loud bangs. My heart jumped into overdrive as I sprinted through the house, flung the door open, and found nothing. No one. Yet there was a sensation. Cold, but not in the way the night air was cold. It was more like the suffocating awareness of someone standing just behind you, watching. Only there was nobody there. When I turned, she was standing close again. She told me, almost matter-of-factly, that they wanted in, but couldn't come unless she allowed it. I asked if maybe someone was playing a trick on her, or if she had cameras to catch it. She ignored the question and instead returned to her chair in the living room, facing the line of dolls. She mentioned that they used to be louder, that they used to shout, but now they only knocked. I didn't stay much longer. I filed the report, recommended that she reach out to any family she might have, and asked the local mental health team to check in on her. A few days later, I followed up with dispatch to see if she'd called again. That's when things got stranger. They told me there was no record of any call from that address. No name. No history. I've told this story a handful of times since then, and I still don't know which part bothers me most. The dolls, the knocking, the cold sensation at the back door, or the fact that, on paper, none of it ever happened. Story 5. I've been a firefighter in Albany, New York for over 20 years. My dad did 30 before me, most of that in the Bronx, and finished his career as a fire safety director for one of those sprawling, ancient, state-run mental hospitals that were mostly shut down by the late 90s. If you've ever seen those old red brick complexes with endless wings, some still in limited use, and others just rotting behind locked doors, you know the kind of place. As a kid, it gave me the creeps. My dad never claimed to believe in ghosts, but even he admitted there was something different about that building, the South Wing especially. That part of the hospital had once housed the criminally insane, murderers, cannibals, people you almost think only exist in movies. Once it closed, the wing was sealed off completely. No lights, no heat, no upkeep. Just chains on the double doors and years of dust. But even abandoned wings had to be included in fire safety inspections, which meant checking alarm panels no matter how long they'd been disconnected. Back in 2013, about a year before my dad retired, he was walking an OSHA inspector and her assistant through for a routine inspection. The working areas were straightforward enough, clean, lit, updated to code. But the inspector insisted on seeing every part of the property, including the South Wing. My dad, not keen on setting foot in there, handed them a heavy flashlight and the keys and told them he'd monitor the radio in case they needed anything. He didn't go beyond the first set of doors himself. Less than 5 minutes later, the radio started crackling. They were reporting movement down there, shuffling noises, and the sound of a man's voice somewhere in the distance. My dad told them sound carried strangely in those old corridors, and it was probably nothing more than echoes. Still, they kept calling in every couple of minutes to say they heard someone just ahead of them, though they never actually saw anyone. And then, suddenly, they went silent. 20 minutes passed with no updates. My dad tried to raise them on the radio, but got nothing. When they finally reappeared, they looked pale and shaken, gathering their equipment like they couldn't leave fast enough. They said they weren't finishing the inspection of that wing, and they didn't explain further. My dad wasn't the type to scare easy, but the way they looked made him curious enough to take a quick walk in himself, just to check an alarm panel they'd skipped. He told the front desk to give him 10 minutes and call if he didn't come back, then grabbed the flashlight, his clipboard, and the keys. The second he stepped past the chain double doors, the smell hit him. Damp mildew, rust, and something faintly animal. The air felt heavier, colder. He swore it must have dropped 10 degrees the moment the doors closed behind him. The corridor stretched long in both directions, lined with heavy steel cell doors, each with a tiny mesh-covered window too rusted to see through. His flashlight beam carved narrow slices of light ahead of him as he walked toward cell 118, where the old alarm panel was mounted. Not long after he started down the hall, he heard it too. At first it wasn't words, just a low, continuous murmur, like someone whispering to themselves. He swept the flashlight both ways, but the corridor was empty. As he got closer to the panel, the whispering faded, replaced by something worse, the sound of footsteps, not echoing distantly, not distorted, close, right behind him, keeping his pace. He turned fast, but there was no one there. The alarm panel itself was dead, its diagnostic light long gone. That was when the pressure started. The flashlight beam dimmed as if the batteries were giving out. The air seemed to thicken, and he felt that prickling sensation along the back of his neck, the kind that makes you sure someone's eyes are on you. He described it later as the feeling of being surrounded, not by one person, but by a whole crowd just out of sight. He turned to leave, walking steadily, refusing to run. But then, about 20 feet away, just across from one of the old cell doors, something began to take shape. It was slow, like fog solidifying into a silhouette. A tall figure, head tilted at an unnatural angle, arms hanging lower than they should. The detail that stopped him cold was the face, or what should have been the face. There were two perfectly round, dark holes where the eyes should have been, like someone had bored them straight through. The thing didn't walk. It didn't even sway. It seemed to glide forward, like it was sliding through the air instead of touching the floor. Its torso was solid enough to see, but below the waist it was nothing but darkness, curling into the cracked linoleum, moving like smoke underwater. It never made a sound, yet he felt something in his skull, a kind of pressure behind the eyes, as if it were trying to get inside his thoughts. He backed away, slow and deliberate, never taking his eyes off it. When he reached the doors, his hands shook so badly he fumbled with the keys. The figure kept coming, closing the space between them in that strange, dragging way. He managed to get the lock open, shoved the door wide, and in that moment the flashlight flickered again. Instinct made him glance back down the hall. And there was nothing, just the empty corridor, still and silent. The cold remained, but the presence was gone. He locked the doors behind him and walked straight back to the front desk without saying much. When they asked if everything was okay, he just told them he was finished with that wing for good. Story 6. I've been working with the Sheriff's Department in Mono County for close to a decade now, mostly doing night patrol. The kind of shift where you get long stretches of nothing but dark highway, pine trees, and your own thoughts for company, and sometimes you wish you didn't have to be alone with them. I've dealt with everything from drunks trying to dig their cars out of snowbanks to the sound of mountain lions screaming like babies in the dead of night. But nothing I've experienced compares to one call we got near Rock Creek Road. It was the kind of incident that, even now, I'm not sure I can explain in a way that makes sense. It was around 2:40 a.m., bitterly cold, the sort of cold that feels like it gets into your bones. My partner that night was Torres. Dispatch came through with a 911 call from a woman saying there were people in her yard holding a baby up toward the sky and chanting. Those were her exact words. Torres and I glanced at each other and figured it was probably drugs, meth heads doing something bizarre, or maybe some kind of domestic disturbance that had gotten out of hand. Either way, we weren't expecting anything out of the ordinary beyond the usual small-town weirdness. It took about 20 minutes to get up there. The road twisted into the forest. No lights, no nearby businesses, just thick pines and rock. The house was set back from the road, hidden behind a rusted gate and half covered by trees. Without knowing exactly where to look, you could have driven by 100 times and never noticed it was there. When we stepped out of the cruiser, the first thing that hit me wasn't the cold, it was the silence. No wind through the trees, no creak of branches, no dogs barking from a neighbor's yard. It was like the whole place was holding its breath. Torres muttered that he hated calls like this, and I couldn't disagree. The porch lights were on, but they were weak and flickering, like they could go out at any moment. The house had a neglected look, as though it had been lived in just enough to keep it from falling apart, but never cared for properly. We crunched along the gravel path toward the front door, and I knocked. That's when I heard shuffling, boots on concrete, coming from my left. Heavy, quick steps, like someone trying to get around the corner before I could see them. I swung my flashlight toward the sound, but the patio was empty. I called out and got nothing. I knocked again, harder this time, and from inside I heard voices, one male, one female, arguing or speaking quickly. That actually calmed me a bit. It made the situation feel more like a domestic problem we could manage. The door opened a moment later, just a narrow gap, and a woman peered out. She looked exhausted, pale, like she hadn't slept in days. She immediately asked us to come in and close the door behind us. Inside, the place was cluttered but not dirty, smelling faintly of incense and old wood. She led us straight into the living room, where a baby monitor was set up on a folding table, the screen showing a night vision view of the front patio, the same spot where Torres and I had just been standing. I was about to start asking about the man I'd heard when knocking, but before I could, she insisted she had been alone all night. I looked at Torres and could see he'd heard the voices too. She began explaining that she had been reading when the monitor picked up what she first assumed was the TV. Low chanting sounds. But when she glanced at the screen, she saw two tall figures standing on the patio. They weren't moving, just holding something above one of their heads. That was when she made the call to 911. As she told the story, the monitor erupted with an ear-splitting burst of static, so loud it made all of us flinch. The screen still showed the empty patio, bathed in that eerie green glow, but the sound kept swelling and fading in strange patterns, almost like wind. But outside, the trees were perfectly still. The woman, visibly shaken, handed me her phone, saying she had taken pictures of the figures when she first saw them. I scrolled through the images, most of them too blurry or dark to make out, until I found one that froze me. Two tall shapes stood at the door. They were just black. No facial features, no texture, like something cut out of the night itself. One of them held a pale object overhead, limp and long. I couldn't tell if it was a bundle or something else. The next photo showed the figures closer, and the object was now lying at the base of the door. I called Torres back in, and we stepped out onto the patio. The cold hit hard, but it was more than just physical. It was as if the air didn't want us there. We searched the yard, scanned the tree line, but there was nothing. No footprints in the frost, no movement, no sound. It was as if the scene we had seen on the monitor never happened. Torres didn't say much, just stared out into the trees for a long moment before muttering that he didn't want to talk about it. When we went back inside, the woman had already decided she wasn't staying. She grabbed her purse and keys, saying she'd be driving into Bishop for the night. Torres and I didn't try to convince her otherwise. We walked her to her car, watched her speed off down the dark road, and then stood there for a moment in that dead silence before heading back to the cruiser. Neither of us said a word the entire drive back. Even now, years later, I'm not sure what we saw, or if we even saw anything at all. But I know what I heard, and I know that air on that patio didn't feel right. Maybe someone could come up with a logical explanation for it, but every time I think back to those pictures, I'm not so sure. Story 7. I never expected an ordinary night shift to leave me questioning reality for years afterward. My name's Mike Donovan, and back then I was a lieutenant with our county's fire and EMS service in a small Midwestern town. The place was the kind where most emergencies turned out to be false alarms, burnt toast, or a small electrical fire that never spread beyond a wall panel. You get used to that rhythm. Most calls are predictable, even dull. But that night, everything took a turn into something I still can't explain without feeling my skin crawl. It started with a routine dispatch to a residential fire alarm on the far edge of town. I had been covering extra hours because of staffing shortages and wasn't expecting anything serious. Still, as we rolled up the long road leading to the address, I caught sight of a strange, muted orange glow in the distance. It wasn't the flickering, chaotic light of a normal fire. It was softer, steadier, like something shining from behind thick curtains. My colleague muttered a comment about how odd it looked, but I brushed it off as maybe a reflection from a street lamp or a shed burning out back. The house itself was a two-story place, maybe 4,000 square feet, ordinary in design but unsettlingly quiet. From the outside, it looked like it should have been occupied, yet there was no sign of anyone waiting for us, no frantic homeowner waving us down. I was told by the first crews on scene that a fire had started at the rear and had grown faster than expected, forcing them into a full suppression effort. By the time I established myself near the rear window to coordinate, most of the flames had been knocked down. Still, something felt off. I couldn't put my finger on it. Just a vague, persistent sense that we weren't seeing the whole picture. As we began winding down operations, I noticed something strange. A faint trail of smoke was drifting from a second-story window on the northeast corner. According to the layout, there shouldn't have been any active hotspots there. I relayed the observation over the radio, but the crews inside insisted they couldn't find anything unusual. They sounded certain, too certain, and their casual dismissal didn't ease the knot forming in my gut. Years of experience had taught me that when something doesn't add up, you double-check. I told one of the interior teams to take a closer look in the area corresponding to that window. The response came back that the space was just a hallway with no sign of fire or even a door. That didn't sit right with me. I decided to go in myself. Inside, the smell of wet ash and scorched wood clung to the air. I climbed the staircase slowly, each creak of the boards echoing in the near-total silence. I reached the upper hallway and realized that, according to the blueprints in my head, there should have been a room where that window was, but there wasn't, just a plain section of wall. I swept my flashlight beam across the surface and stopped when it hit the glass of an actual window embedded in the wall. On the other side was the cold night air, but inside there was no sign of the room that should have been there. The hallway felt unnervingly still, like the air itself was holding its breath. My instincts screamed that something was concealed behind that wall. I radioed down that I was going to breach it and set to work. The first strikes of my tool cracked the drywall, sending small clouds of dust into the beam of my flashlight. The sound echoed oddly, too hollow, as though the space beyond was larger than it had any right to be. A cold draft whispered out through the growing hole, carrying a damp, almost metallic smell that didn't belong in a residential house. I kept going until the drywall gave way enough to reveal a narrow, dust-choked passage. Crawling inside, I found a small, old-fashioned door tucked at the end. It didn't match the rest of the house's style and looked untouched for decades. My pulse thudded in my ears as I turned the handle. It opened without resistance, revealing a perfectly preserved child's bedroom. Everything inside looked like it had been frozen in time. A small bed with a neatly folded quilt, an old wooden dresser, a tiny desk, and a faded rug. The air was thick and stale, heavy in a way that made me feel as though I had stepped into a place I wasn't supposed to find. I stood there, taking it in, my mind racing to come up with a logical explanation. Maybe it was some kind of sealed-off space from a renovation, forgotten over the years. But then the unease in my gut deepened. I couldn't shake the feeling that I wasn't alone in that room. It was nothing obvious. No shadows moving, no sudden noise, just an almost tangible sense of being watched. That's when I heard it. At first it was so faint I thought it was the house settling, but it wasn't the groan of timber or the crackle of cooling wood. It was softer, rhythmic, almost like a whisper or a low hum. It carried a note of sadness, deliberate enough that it couldn't be mistaken for something mechanical. My skin prickled, and every muscle in my body tensed. I tried to tell myself it was the wind funneling oddly through the breach in the wall. I wanted to believe that, but standing there, staring at the stillness of that untouched room, I knew I couldn't. The air felt heavier with every passing second, as though the space itself was pushing me out. My training told me to be thorough, but my instincts told me to leave. I took a last lingering look at the room, burned its image into my mind, and backed out of the passage, the cold draft following me like something alive. When I got back into the main hallway, the normal sounds of the scene, the distant chatter of radios, the clang of tools, seemed almost too loud, like they were trying to drown out what I'd just experienced. A voice over the radio asked what I'd seen. I hesitated for a long moment before saying only that I'd found something I couldn't explain. Nobody pressed for details, and I didn't volunteer them. The rest of the night passed in a haze of routine work, but my mind never left that hidden room. Even now, I don't know what I walked into that night. Maybe it was just a forgotten part of the house, a relic sealed away by some long-ago owner. But there's a part of me, deep down, that believes something else was in there, something that didn't want to be found. And I can't decide which possibility is worse. Story 8. I've never told this story to anyone. Not my wife, not my partner, not even the other guys in my squad. For years, I worked sex crimes for the Seattle PD, mostly involving children. People say it's the worst assignment on the force. They're right. You either last a few months or you manage years, but no matter how long, it chews you up in the same way. I made it 7 years before I transferred out, and that was long enough to see things I'll never forget. One of those nights happened in February of 2019, a freezing black winter night just after midnight. A woman walked into West Precinct holding a small child by the hand. She was bleeding from her mouth and nose, her clothes torn, her hands trembling so hard she could barely sign her name. The boy, 3 or 4 at most, was barefoot and silent. She moved with a kind of mechanical determination, as if the only thing keeping her upright was the fact that she still had his hand in hers. When I took her into the interview room, she said her ex had attacked her during a custody exchange. Not just assault, but the kind of cruelty that sticks with you if you hear it described in detail. I'll spare you that part. She claimed he'd had a knife to her neck, ready to kill her, but something made him stop. She didn't know why, only that his expression changed in an instant, like he'd seen something that froze the blood in his veins. Then he bolted. I asked how she'd gotten to the station, and she told me she'd walked. The address she gave was over 3 miles away. No coat, in the cold, in the middle of the night, with a barefoot toddler. She didn't even remember making the decision to leave, only that suddenly she felt she could, and she just ran. The next morning, I sat in on the forensic interview with the child. At first, it went the way these interviews usually do: hesitation, small details, avoiding eye contact. But when I asked if he remembered anything after his father got angry, he looked upward, as though focusing on something just above him, and said there had been a nice woman there. She was shiny, he told me, with a bright white light around her, so bright he couldn't see past her. She smelled like flowers. She'd held him, told him it was going to be okay, and sang a strange song in a voice he couldn't quite describe. Something like an old woman's voice, but not exactly. She told him to be brave, then knocked loudly on the door. After that, she led them to the car before flying away. He said it like it was the most normal thing in the world. I didn't include those details in my report. You learn not to put shiny flying woman into official paperwork, but I wrote it down for myself. We picked up the suspect later that day. He was a mess, sweating, jittery, completely deflated. He confessed to everything almost immediately, giving exact details without hesitation. But when I asked why he hadn't gone through with the killing, his demeanor changed. He said he'd been ready to do it, knife at her throat, when he heard 3 loud knocks at the door. He'd been sure it was the police, but when he looked through the peephole, there was no one there. That was when he felt it, like someone else was inside the apartment with him. The air had gotten heavy, almost like he was underwater. He couldn't breathe. He didn't think. He just ran. Later that afternoon, I went to the scene. The apartment still held that kind of energy you sometimes feel after violence, like the air hasn't reset yet. Blood on the carpet, broken dishes, overturned furniture. On the front door, I saw them. 3 distinct dents in the wood, knuckle-shaped, each perfectly spaced as if someone had rapped hard on it. They were deep enough to fit a hand to. No scratches, no splinters, just clean impressions. The landlord said no one had reported hearing knocks that night. The woman hadn't called anyone before leaving, and no neighbors had stepped in. When I asked the mother again about the moments before she escaped, she said she'd heard it too. Three knocks at the door, loud enough to make her attacker freeze. She saw him glance toward the sound in terror before running. She hadn't moved at first, paralyzed, but then something in her shifted, and she knew she had to grab her child and leave. She couldn't explain it except to say that she suddenly felt safe, as though someone had arrived for them. I kept the photo I took of those dents on the door, probably against protocol, but I couldn't bring myself to file it away and forget it. I've worked in law enforcement long enough to know that people are capable of unimaginable horrors, and I don't believe in ghosts or angels. But that night, something else was in that apartment, and whatever it was, it made a violent man drop his knife and run. Story 9. I've never shared this with anyone outside my family, mostly because I never liked the way it sat in my head afterward. It happened when I was still working with the Allen County Sheriff's Department in Northwest Ohio. We were a small department dealing with small town issues, the occasional meth bust, domestic disputes, break-ins, and the usual teenage trouble. I worked nights, and after a while, you learn to live with the silence. Some nights it's a comfortable, easy quiet, and other nights it's the kind that makes you overthink every shadow you pass. It was late October, 2012, or maybe 2013, when a call came through just before midnight. It wasn't an emergency, just a report from someone who claimed they were driving past the old Ashcroft Mill and saw lights flickering inside. That mill had been shut down since the 80s, a huge, cold, concrete structure that stood empty and rotting in the dark. Locals told stories about it, and kids from all over would try to sneak in around Halloween just for the thrill. Normally, these calls turned out to be kids waving flashlights or setting off little campfires, so I didn't think much of it at first. But the detail that stuck out and made both me and my partner Cal take the report more seriously was that the caller said the second, third, and fourth floors weren't just lit by flashlights. They claimed the entire floors were glowing. They even used the word fire, though they'd seen no smoke. That was odd. We let dispatch know we were checking it out and made our way there. The mill sat about half a mile back from the main road, behind an old set of train tracks. Pulling into the gravel lot, it was immediately clear the caller hadn't been exaggerating. There was light coming from the upper floors, an orange-yellow flicker that didn't match any artificial light I knew of. It was bright enough to leak out through the cracked windows, but strangely, the first floor was completely dark. The air was still, and there was no smell, nothing that suggested fire. We radioed the fire department just in case, but something about it felt wrong. Inside, the first floor was colder than it should have been, the kind of cold that settles into your bones. The place was completely bare. No squatters, no trash, not even footprints in the dust. Usually there were signs of people passing through, but now it felt like no one had stepped foot in there for years. We found the west stairwell and started climbing. When we reached the second floor, the glow was gone. Only our flashlights lit the way. The entire floor was empty, save for some old machinery and rust. We searched every inch. No kids, no lights, no lanterns. The third floor was the same. The fourth too, and the fifth. By the time we reached the roof, we hadn't found so much as a burned match. It was on the roof that I glanced back toward the parking lot and saw it. The light again. It was coming from the very same floors we had just searched. Cal saw it too, and for a moment we both just stood there staring down, trying to process how that could even be possible. The fire crew was pulling up at that moment, and they hadn't seen anyone enter the building either. We hurried back down the stairwell, but this time, somewhere above us, there was a sound. It was faint, like something heavy being dragged across concrete. We froze, listening. It came again, this time clearly from the fifth floor. Instinct took over, and we ran back up. But when we reached the top, the noise had stopped. The room was dark and still, except for one thing. The stairwell we had just come up from was gone. Where the doorway should have been, there was only a solid concrete wall, same as the rest. I ran my hand over it, half expecting to feel a seam or frame, but there was nothing. Cal touched it too, just as confused, and I could see in his face the same sinking realization I felt. There was no way down. That's when I noticed something in the far corner, a pile. At first, I thought it was garbage, but as I got closer, I realized it was a collection of blankets, coats, shoes, and cans. They were old and worn, the kind of things you'd see in the makeshift camp squatters left behind. But they hadn't been scattered. They'd been gathered, neatly folded in some cases, as though someone had deliberately stacked them there. None of it had been there minutes before. The temperature dropped sharply, the kind of sudden cold that feels unnatural. Both of our flashlights began to flicker. That's when I saw movement on the far wall. Not ours, but shadows shifting and crawling as if they had a life of their own. Then, as abruptly as it had vanished, the door reappeared behind us. One moment it was a bare wall, the next it was the same rusted door we had used earlier, complete with a faded fire exit sign. I didn't think, I just moved. We were out of that building and back in the lot in seconds, both of us breathing hard, with the fire crew staring at us like we'd gone crazy. We went in again with them, walking every floor. The glow was gone. The piles were gone. The staircase was exactly where it should have been. There was nothing out of place. No sign anyone had been there. I never slept that day. Even now, I don't know what we saw, but I'm certain of one thing. Whatever was in that mill didn't want us to find it. And for a short while, it made sure we understood that. Story 10. I'd been on the job for over 17 years at that point, patrolling a quiet suburban neighborhood just outside Omaha. The kind of place where the biggest excitement was a noise complaint because some teenager's Bluetooth speaker was too loud. Nights were usually dead quiet, which was exactly how I liked them. But in 2014, there was one call that still sits in the back of my mind, like an itch I can't scratch. It wasn't a big crime scene, nobody got hurt, but something about it felt wrong in a way I've never been able to shake. It was just before 3 a.m. when dispatch sent us out. An elderly woman had called in to report that someone had broken into her basement. She said the light was on down there, even though she hadn't touched it, and she could hear coughing. She'd been very specific about that part. My partner Mike and I saw the address pop up, and I groaned. It was an old brick house tucked away at the end of a cul-de-sac. I'd been there years earlier when her smoke alarm kept going off for no reason. Mrs. Evelyn McCarthy, widow, early 80s, sharp enough but sometimes forgetful, lived alone ever since her husband died back in the 90s. Nice enough woman, always polite, but the type you worry about falling for scam calls. When we pulled up, she was already waiting at the front door in her nightgown, leaning on one of those walker frames. The porch light was buzzing faintly above her head. She looked scared, but in a quiet, resigned kind of way. Not panicked, just certain something was wrong. She told us the basement light had been on when she woke up, and she was sure she'd heard someone down there coughing. She hadn't gone down to check, she said, because she hadn't been in that basement in years. We stepped inside, and the place smelled like old wood and cinnamon, exactly what you'd expect from a grandmother's house. We cleared the main floor first. Everything was exactly where it should be. Then we opened the basement door. The narrow stairwell glowed under a yellow bulb hanging from the ceiling, swaying ever so slightly, like someone had just brushed past it. The air smelled stale and dusty, and each wooden step groaned under our boots. The basement itself was nothing special. Old washer and dryer, stacks of boxes, a rusted exercise bike. There wasn't a sign of anyone having been there. Even the dust on the far wall looked untouched. In the center of the room was a single pull chain light fixture, dangling from the ceiling. I reached up, pulled the chain, and the light clicked off. We locked the door behind us and told her there was nothing to worry about. That's when she asked if we were sure we'd turn the light off. We told her yes, and she asked us to open the door again just so she could see for herself. I did, and froze. The light was back on. Same dim yellow glow, same faint swaying motion. I asked if there was a wall switch somewhere upstairs, and she insisted there wasn't. The only way to turn that light on or off was to pull the chain in the basement. So I went back down, pulled it again, watched it go dark, and stared at it for a good solid minute before coming back up. We told her again everything was fine and started toward the front door. That's when I heard it, a faint metallic click. The exact sound of a chain being pulled. I turned my head and saw the glow spilling up the basement stairs again. The light was on, Mrs. McCarthy hadn't moved an inch. She just looked at me like she'd been expecting it. Mike muttered something about leaving it alone, but I wasn't about to walk away without checking one last time. I went down faster this time, flashlight in hand. The pull chain was swinging like someone had just let go of it. That's when I heard the cough. Low, wet, close, right behind me. I spun around so fast my flashlight beam jumped across the walls, the floor, the ceiling. Nothing. Not a shadow out of place. Just me, that single swaying bulb, and the feeling that I wasn't as alone as I should have been. I didn't bother turning the light off this time. I went straight back upstairs, slammed the door, and locked it. Mrs. McCarthy didn't say another word. She just gave a small nod, almost like I'd confirmed something she'd already known. We logged it as a false alarm with a note about a possible electrical issue. That's the official record. But the truth is, there was nothing electrical about the sound of that cough. And to this day, I don't know what bothers me more. Hearing it or knowing that whoever or whatever was down there was close enough for me to hear their breath.